latitude, Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, there's a lot of advice for how to get your dream job. But what about how to be successful in it once you get there? We'll get tips from a Harvard career advisor. Now, the pandemic has led a lot of people to rethink their current living situation, whether that means choosing to buy or sell a house, move to a new city, consider going more rural. Things like remote work and school and lots of job changes are also broadening people's horizons, but things like high housing costs are also limiting options in some places. The first round of census data released gives a little bit of insight into where people might be moving. The three states that have seen the greatest rate of increase in their population in the last 10 years are Utah, Idaho, then Texas. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you moved in the last year? Across town, across the state, across the country? Are you thinking about moving soon? Do you think remote work may be the wave of the future for you? And what factors determine where you want to live? What are you looking for in a community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Weichelt is an associate professor of geography at UW-Eau Claire. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Big picture, what kind of things are you seeing with trends of where people are coming and going in the United States?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating to see the census map sort of play itself out, but it's kind of continuing trends we've seen in the last 20 years or so, where we're seeing growth in the more or less southern areas, where we're seeing kind of stagnant growth in the northern areas. The three states you mentioned, Utah, Idaho, and Texas, all provide very fascinating different geographies in terms of why people are moving into those particular places and where they're leaving from.
What drives people to up stakes and move? Is it all economics? Is it weather? What factors go into that? And hopefully we'll hear from some of our listeners with their own personal reasons.
Yeah, I mean, certainly generalize. Everyone has their own decisions on why they move. But a lot of the theory associated with migration, the number one reason people do move, it tends to be economic. Does that mean potentially new jobs? Does that mean a family member gets a new job? Is it across town or is it across the entire country? Generally, people move because it's going to be a positive and they're probably going to make more economic sense moving to a new place compared to where they were. So economics certainly drives that, but I think the pandemic sort of has upended in that stuff a little bit.
Now, I've seen information pre-pandemic, some thoughts that we're becoming more sedentary in the United States. We're less likely to up stakes and move than we used to. And I know people might use different yardsticks to come up with conclusions. Had that been a trend?
I think if you live in certain areas and if you live in bigger cities, you tend to move more often in larger urban areas versus if you're in smaller urban areas into rural areas, you tend to move less. I think remote work, I we'll probably talk about that, but I think that sort of helps with that mentality is it provides you more flexibility what you're going to do and potentially could make you more sedentary in that particular sense.
Yeah, the census data, if I understand correctly, the yardstick, it applied to kind of very early in the pandemic. So it may not reflect, as I understand it, a lot of trends that may have emerged, you know, say in the second half of last year. What kind of things are you looking at as far as how the pandemic may have shaken up people's decisions on where they want to live?
I think we're all kind of chomping at the bit waiting for the census data to come out with the county level, census tract level, to get a better sense of what's happening with that. I think some regional trends that you might see, you know, we can use Wisconsin as an example. There were discussions where people moving up to the Northwoods because they were getting away from the Milwaukee or Madison area. We've seen sort of that take place in New York as people have left New York City and moving up into the upper parts of New York or even down into Florida. So I think that the newest census data, if it can kind of gauge some of that information, is to see, are these trends as popular as maybe the media made it out to be, or are they not as exciting as maybe some of us want to believe, that you can just zip off to a lake and spend the rest of your life working off the dock.
Talking to Ryan Weichelt, associate professor of geography at UW-Eau Claire, looking at trends in people moving, where they move from and to, what is driving those decisions. We're looking at some big picture stuff, and we're hoping you can zoom in on the details of your own life, your own decision, your own maybe family or community. Have you made the decision to move over the last year or two? What drove that? Have you gone from big city to small town or vice versa? Have you joined us here in Wisconsin from elsewhere in the country? What led to that decision? And has the pandemic made you rethink what is important in a place to live? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Young people, Ryan, I think are known often as the people most likely to move, leave their hometown, go to the big city or whatever. Is that borne out generally in reality?
Oh, yeah, definitely. The younger you are, the less likely you're connected to a place. You maybe don't have children. That really kind of keeps people in place, having children. Young people definitely move more than any other group.
And you've been quoted in a couple of pieces looking at how migration trends, people moving from one state to another in particular, may affect American politics. What kind of things are you looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is sort of borne out with the numbers that came out last week. You're seeing that growth again in the South compared to the northern parts. And for political purposes, you might see this, you did see this with the terms of reapportionment and the number of seats that people, that states are getting for the House of Representatives, but you're also seeing it sort of borne out in terms of statewide elections and then some of the laws that are being now passed in some of these states to sort of suppress some of the vote, which is being driven by large population increases.
Right. So a person moving from one state to another doesn't leave their politics at the state border, presumably.
Oh, certainly not. And I think, you know, some of the information that's coming out, I mean, we saw what happened with the growth in places like Arizona and Georgia. These are states that were traditionally very strong Republican states. And then you see the very small margins of victory for the presidency for Joe Biden in 2020. These trends will just continue because younger people as a whole tend to bring their politics with them and are sort of leaning more towards Democratic voters compared to Republican voters.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Christina is with us in Madison. Christina, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks.
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I was listening to your show and thinking about my sister who's moving here from San Francisco. She just closed on a house on Friday. And part of the reason that she decided to relocate is because of the wildfires out west. And she's just terrified of having to flee her home in the middle of the night with her two young kids.
Christina, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And Ryan, I know there's a lot of people look at California and the big cities. People point toward housing costs and things like that. But yeah, the wildfires turning into a potentially year-round phenomenon and the smoke hazing over the streets, that can be a unique factor that leads people out of an area.
Yeah, certainly. One of the parts of migration theory does talk about the impact of natural disasters. Things like hurricanes. We saw sort of that influence in the Katrina era in Louisiana, but certainly the fires, drought, all these things sort of play into people's minds. And if you're constantly, I've lived in California and you're constantly dealing with those fires, it can be tiresome.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Ryan Weichelt, Associate Professor of Geography at UW-Eau Claire. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has what you look for in a place to live, a community to live in, changed in the last 10 years? Or how about the last 1 year? What kind of places interest you the most right now? Have you moved recently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Ryan Weichelt, Associate Professor at UW-Eau Claire, studying geography and anthropology. We're talking about moving and what makes a place a good place to live. You could join in with your story or where you want to live, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls with Carolyn in Southwest Wisconsin. Carolyn, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Carolyn?
I thought I would come in with maybe a different perspective than most people might come in with. I don't know. But I'm from Chicago. I'm actually in Southwest Wisconsin right now in the Driftless area where my parents live and have had a place for over 25 years. And I'm helping them move because not only are they getting older, which I don't think is like the major factor for them is they have a beautiful forest and a cabin in the woods in the Driftless area, and there's a enormous CAFO farm going in next to them, which they, with other community members, tried to kind of fight about. And they, you know, to say the least, they decided to say, you know what, we're out of here. We're not going to live next to that. And so they're selling their place and moving closer to us in Chicago, not in Chicago, but closer in Illinois. And taxes are higher there and everything too. So it's not like an easy decision for them. But yeah, I mean, we're a little heartbroken about the whole thing, but happy they'll be closer.
That sounds great.
And sad to see this place we've loved for over 25 years in this beautiful Driftless area that's geologically extremely special, you know, we won't have it anymore.
Carolyn, thank you so much for sharing that story. Interesting push and pull going on there, Ryan. A beautiful area. Don't like the big, I assume, dairy farm next door. So across the border, they do it to Illinois. People are weighing a lot of different factors.
Yeah, that's certainly that's one where most people are leaving Illinois. So I guess Illinois is getting some people back a little bit. But all joking aside, certainly the reasons why people move are certainly multifaceted, and many places have dealt with that sort of not in my backyard situation. You just don't want to deal with if it's a CAFO, if it's industry, that those can all be negative things that people are weighing that make people decide that, you know, maybe they didn't want to move, but the idea of moving somewhere else might be a little bit better.
Carolyn, thanks for sharing the story. Good luck with helping with the move. We'll go to Rick next in Madison. Rick, hi.
Hi, how's it going there, Rob?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Rick? What do you got going on?
Oh, well, I love Wisconsin. I'm a native from Watertown, and I've been living in Madison most of my adult life, but the pandemic has made me reflect, and I'm planning on relocating to Albuquerque, New Mexico at the end of June for many reasons, some of them being lower cost of living and lower housing costs, the wide open spaces and outdoor recreation there. And I have been looking at other Western states, like you mentioned, Utah, Idaho, Colorado, those booming states, but cost of living is just a deterrent for those places, as beautiful as they are. So New Mexico is kind of more of a happy medium. So that's my plan.
Rick, thank you so much for sharing that. Sorry we're losing you from Wisconsin, but good luck on the move. Don't take a wrong turn at Albuquerque like Bugs Bunny used to do. Ryan, cost of living, cost of housing. Can you talk about what a big factor that can be?
I mean, I think that's probably one of the main reasons why you're seeing places like California and New York losing populations. The cost of living is so extremely high. I think San Francisco is probably the best example of seeing rents and housing costs in the millions of dollars for 1,200 square foot apartment. Those are big reasons people are leaving. And I think Idaho being brought up, and New Mexico is a beautiful place too, but Idaho is seeing that population growth where corporations have left California and moved to Idaho because of the cheaper cost of living, and the people came along with it, much more happy. They're also then attached to that nature sort of idea that many people like seeing the mountains and being able to get out into nature, and that becomes a really popular thing to help people move. But that cost of living is probably the main factor of getting them to move from one place to another.
Rick, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. Ryan, as we look at states like California, I mean, they lose a congressional seat. Their population rate increase has slowed, but they're still a bigger state than they were 10 years ago. I think sometimes people portray it as, you know, California is just losing people in droves. The population is going up, just not as fast as places like Texas and others, right?
Exactly. I mean, 47 states all grew in population between 2010 and 2020. You look at it, they're based on, you know, the percentage, where we're sort of normalizing some of this data. The three states that lost were West Virginia, Illinois, and Mississippi. California still gained millions and millions of people. It's just much slower growth than they've ever experienced. It's the first time they've actually lost a seat ever. Mm-hmm. Because for a long, yeah.
Yeah. So as we look toward the future, Ryan, I mean, we can't predict the future, but do you expect to see a lot of these trends, people moving from, say, states in the Midwest to warmer states elsewhere? Is that something you think we're likely to see down the road, too?
Yeah, I think the question that a lot of people are trying to figure out is how much is this going to continue? And I think that question about remote work is sort of the million-dollar question, is how many companies are actually going to really jump in and say, hey, we're fine with remote work? Because that idea of remote work is something, I'd say, on a larger scale, new to any person working in a job. That ability to live wherever you want and that freedom to go wherever you want is very appealing. And so you've seen corporations like Twitter, I think, was the first big one that said they're going to continue to do remote work up here by Eau Claire near Minneapolis. Target Corporation had decided that one of their big buildings was all going to be remote. If those trends continue, you're going to see probably greater amounts of movement to these places that people find desirable because of cost of living, it's this environment. But if it doesn't continue, right, and it's not as big, maybe the movement isn't going to be as great. And people are going to be pushed to the traditional areas. But I think you're still going to continue to see that southern, southwest sort of growth compared to the lagging growth compared to the old industrial areas of the United States.
And let's wrap up with things close to home here. What kind of trends are you watching for in Wisconsin? I know preliminary census data shows Dane County and surrounding counties are driving the growth in Wisconsin. What do you have your eye on here?
Yeah, I do. Certainly Dane County has continued this trend. But I think you're starting to see, you know, my own city that I live in Eau Claire is sort of in a unique geographic position that if that remote work is really continued, there's a number of people I know that live here in Eau Claire that work in the Twin Cities. And allowing that sort of remote work to continue could allow a place like an Eau Claire or some of these smaller, say, cities of 100,000, a bit more opportunity because of the cheaper cost of living and some of the amenities associated with that. If you do need to go to work, it's only an hour and a half drive away, but you can continue to do things remotely. And so I think seeing those trends of those cities on the periphery of the bigger areas to see how corporations and businesses are adjusting to this idea of the new remote working that potentially is upon us.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you so much.
Ryan Weichel is an associate professor of geography at UW-Eau Claire. He joined us to talk about what makes a place desirable to live and how the pandemic could change that. Since video footage captured the killing of George Floyd, Wisconsin agencies have said they'll review their use of force policies, and they've invested in body cameras. Corrine Hess reports that families of those killed by police officers in Wisconsin are hoping the footage can lead to justice.
When Joel Acevedo died from injuries at the hands of an off-duty Milwaukee police officer last spring, his parents, Maribel and Jose, were told their son had been the aggressor. Months later, the Acevedos saw police body camera footage that they say showed them a different version of events. At a press conference in December, Maribel said the 40 hours of footage needed to be released publicly.
It's black and white evidence that there is no justification for what he did to my son. I don't care what narrative they have. It is not justifiable.
The judge in the case, William Pucan, is expected to rule on the releasing of the footage tomorrow. Joel Acevedo died on April 25th, 2020, 6 days after being in a chokehold for 11 minutes and 20 seconds. He was at a party at the home of former Milwaukee police officer Michael Mattioli when he reportedly got into a fight that led to the strangling. Mattioli has been charged with first-degree reckless homicide. His attorney says releasing the tape would interfere with his ability to receive a fair trial. Acevedo family attorney B. Ivory Lamar says the public has a right to know what happened.
You see the body camera footage, I think it paints a completely different picture, and I think that will provide the basis as to the public understanding why it's being fought so hard for it to not be made available.
In recent weeks, there have been several high-profile killings by police officers where video footage was quickly released to the public. First, former Brooklyn Center, Minnesota police officer Kim Potter was charged with second-degree manslaughter after fatally shooting Dante Wright during a traffic stop. Many believe the charges came quickly because footage from Potter's body-worn camera was released right away. Days later in Chicago, police released footage revealing 13-year-old Adam Toledo's empty hands were raised above his shoulders when he was fatally shot by an officer the month before, a very different scenario than what police originally reported. A Wisconsin Department of Justice survey released earlier this year found 3/4 of the departments that responded used body cameras. Of those, about 88% say they've been using the devices for at least a year. Cynthia Lum is a criminology professor at George Mason University. She says body cameras are only as good as the policies that dictate how they're used.
People and the police can feel and have perceptions one way or about one thing, but I think the more important thing is whether or not body-worn cameras actually deliver on the outcomes that we expect from them.
In the Milwaukee suburb of Wauwatosa, police officers have been wearing body cameras since February. Sergeant Abby Pavlik says the cameras are always on, and when an officer is about to have an interaction, they activate the camera. Videos are saved for at least 3 months. Pavlik says Wauwatosa would release footage on a case-by-case basis.
Anytime we release footage or any type of kind of an open records, we base it on the public's need to know versus we weigh that balance of what needs to be seen to preservation of, you know, evidence or somebody's personal information.
Jay Anderson Sr. wishes Wauwatosa officers were wearing body cameras in 2016 when former officer Joseph Menza fatally shot his son. Menza approached Jay Anderson Jr. while he was sleeping in his car. Family members say he was inebriated, but Menza says Anderson was reaching for a gun when he shot him. Menza was never charged in the killing, but Jay Anderson Sr. thinks his story may not have held up if there was video of the encounter.
A body cam is what we need on every police force in the United States.
As the Acevedo family awaits the murder trial of former Milwaukee police officer Michael Mattioli, they hope the release of the body cam footage will provide clarity in the moments that led to their son's death. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Harvard career advisor about the unspoken rules of the workplace and how to navigate them and figure out what they are in the first place to be successful on the job. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the latest efforts to share the history and culture of Wisconsin's Native Americans, past and present. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, getting started in your career can be hard, but being successful after you get the job is difficult too. Our next guest says starting a new job can be like visiting a foreign country or like your first day of school. He says there are unspoken rules in the work world, and while some people learned them early on, others have to figure them out the hard way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What were some of the challenges you ran into maybe when you were starting off your career? What do you wish you knew then that you know now about getting along at the work world? What have you done to overcome challenges? How has it worked out for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Gorik Ng is a research associate at the Harvard Business School's Managing the Future of Work Project. He's a career advisor at Harvard and author of the new book, The Unspoken Rules, Secrets to Starting Your Career Off Right. Gorik, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
In your book, you talk about, actually, you start with your mom's story about the first time you figured out that there were these unspoken, unwritten rules over how to find and get jobs. Can you talk about that a little?
That's right. It was a few decades ago now, but I was 14 years old, minding my own business, when all of a sudden my mom came home with a slip from her workplace. It said that she had been laid off due to a downsizing. She had spent her life working in a sewing machine factory and had never written a resume or cover letter before. So I, as the person in the house who knew how to get onto the internet, who knew how to use Google or whatever it was back then, became the person to step up and to help her get back on her feet. So I went to the public library during my recesses and after schools to learn how to write resumes and cover letters. And then evenings spent coaching my mom over the dinner table all through trial and error. And it was from that experience that I realized, wow, there's so much more to building a career than just reading job descriptions online and following the explicit directions. There's so much that's unspoken and unwritten.
And then you kind of relived that as you were, I think, the first college graduate in your family, the first person seeking the kind of jobs that you'd want after getting that college degree. What kind of things did you run into that made you think more about these unwritten rules?
Yeah, I remember this one time I was walking home from the library on campus. I was decked out in jeans and a hoodie. My classmates were dressed up in suits. They were walking the other direction. Turns out that they were off to an invite-only recruiting event put on by one of the recruiters that had come onto the college campus. I had gone to that career fair that afternoon, but it turns out that I was there looking for this free swag. I was picking up stickers and water bottles. They were saying the right things to the right people. And lo and behold, fast forward a couple of hours, they got invited to this invite-only reception that I didn't even know existed. So that was a big rude awakening. It made me realize that there's so much more to this process, that career fairs aren't just about learning. It's about saying the right things to the right people.
In writing this book, you talk to a lot of employees and employers about some of the challenges, the unexpected hurdles people can face in a new job. Take us to somebody's first day on the job. You're in a new place. As you read the book, it can be like being in a foreign country. How do we start to survey the landscape to figure out what those unspoken rules are?
Oh, there's so much to be dealing with. I would say that to start, it might be helpful to first think about whether your first day, first week resembles, to your point earlier, more of the first day in a new class where the syllabus is nicely laid out, where you have check-ins with this and that person, where your first assignments are nicely handed to you, clearly laid out as well. Or if it, to your point, is more like dropping yourself into a foreign country, where I've interviewed plenty of early career professionals and mid-career professionals alike who show up on their first day only to realize that their own manager doesn't even know that they're showing up and their coworkers are too busy to even be saying hello to them. And so if you find yourself in such a situation, it's helpful to really take ownership of the situation. There's this unspoken expectation that you won't just wait for assignments to come to you. You'll go up to your coworkers and to say, how can I be helpful? Is there anything I can do to be helpful? Or would it be helpful if I did X? And at the same time, proactively introducing yourself to your coworkers and saying, Rob, I don't think we've met. I'm the newbie on the team, came from this and that company. Nice to meet you. Would love to learn more about what you're working on and how I can be helpful. So these little steps that may seem like common sense in retrospect really may not be common sense, especially if you're expecting to have your hands held in that first day.
Talking to Gorik Ng about his new book, The Unspoken Rules, Secrets to Starting Your Career Off Right. You can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your experiences, maybe that bewildering first day on a job, what you wish you'd known coming in, how you overcame that. Or if you're a manager, an employer, what kind of things do you wish your employees knew and how to demonstrate their abilities maybe from day one? 800-642-1234. A core of a lot of what you talk about, Gorik, for that maybe new or early career employee is demonstrating something you call the three C's. Can you spell those out for us?
Yes. The three C's stand for competence, commitment, and compatibility. And the idea is this. The minute you present yourself in a professional work setting, whether it's in a cover letter, an interview, your resume, and certainly on your first day, your coworkers, managers, and clients, they're sizing you up and they're asking themselves three questions. Question one, can you do this job well? Which is competence. Are you excited to be here? Which is question two. And that's what I call commitment. And finally, question three, are you excited to be here? Question two is, are you excited to be here, which is commitment. Mm-hmm. And finally, do we get along, which is compatibility. Your job as a newbie is to convince the people around you to answer yes to all three questions all the time, that yes, I can do this job well, that yes, I'm excited to be here, and yes, we can get along and we're compatible.
Let's talk about that compatibility, because it can be a challenge. And this is one point where you point out in the book, this can be unfair to some people. You as a first generation college graduate and your family and Asian American, other people who might one way or another, they're from a small town, they're working a big city job, one way or another, there's something that other people see them as not fitting in. When you're in that position, you can't instantly change people to accept people who are different than them. How do you meet them halfway?
It's tough. And I ended up providing a framework in my book where it's helpful to do some self-reflection before you show up, where you ask yourself, what are the elements of my identity that I consider to be sacred? What are the elements that I consider negotiable? And finally, what are the elements that I'm indifferent about? And different people will have different elements of their identity that they'll put into each of these three categories, where I've interviewed individuals who, for example, were Black women working in a very different environment from one that they're used to, and where they had to really make this trade-off between, well, do I straighten my hair on my first day, or do I show up looking my natural self? There are others who will ask themselves, well, I have a name that others may not be as familiar with. Should I create a nickname for myself, or should I allow others to be creating a nickname for me? And then certainly there are obstacles once you show up as well, where if all of your coworkers are talking about, let's say, the same sets of sports teams or vacation spots or television shows, and those aren't necessarily topics that you can relate to, it can feel isolating. And so the advice that I've heard from a number of career professionals is, you know, when in doubt, maybe ask a question. You can't necessarily say, oh, I went to the same vacation spot myself, which obviously would help in that compatibility aspect of things. But maybe you could show interest and say, oh, I've never been there before. I'd love to hear a little bit more about what that experience was like. Really, so much of this has to do with sparking relationships, which is one of these unspoken rules I talk about, which is really just finding excuses to turn someone who's otherwise a stranger into an acquaintance. And once you spark that conversation the first time, it becomes that much more easy to then take them from acquaintance mode to ally mode, which is really where you want to be.
Let's talk more about that. I'll say that's something that I was very shy about in my early work career, and still am, I'll be honest, of like, oh, there's a person, you know, maybe they could help me out in my career, or I could learn from them or something. But I don't know. I never really learned that that's a thing you could do. It feels like I'm imposing on somebody else. How can people be smarter than me and get over that challenge?
Well, you're not alone. I still feel that to this day, where I've certainly found it helpful, and I've heard the same advice mirrored by those I've interviewed, where it can be helpful to find someone who can see you as, if you're early in your career, potentially as someone who can see you as a younger version of themselves, where if you're a new college graduate or a high school graduate or a community college graduate, can you find someone who may have graduated from the same institution or came from the same town or had the same extracurricular activities or social groups or religious groups? Finding even just that slightest hook to be able to say, like you, I blank, I went to this high school, et cetera, can make it a little bit less nerve-wracking to break the ice. And then the other piece that I hear a lot about from managers is to do your homework, which is another one of these unspoken rules around, you may not be able to small talk per se about your mutual TV show or band or musical artist, but maybe you could show interest in their work and say, I was doing some research on your recent efforts in XYZ. Would love to learn more about your efforts here and to see if I can help in any way. Would you have 15 minutes over the phone in the coming days to chat further? Again, it's really finding those excuses, which are around us all the time. They're hidden opportunities waiting for us to take advantage of.
We're talking to Gorik Ng from Harvard about his new book, The Unspoken Rules, Secrets to Starting Your Career Off Right. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Hey, are you about to graduate from something, high school or college, getting ready to hit the job market now? Need some advice from our guest on how to hit the ground running on day one on your job? What are you nervous about? Or if you have advice of your own to share with that new grad at whatever level about how to succeed at work, what do you wish you knew then that you know now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Gorik Ng, Research Associate and Career Advisor at Harvard. We're talking to him about his new book, The Unspoken Rules, Secrets to Starting Your Career Off Right. You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your questions, your experiences from your early days on the job, your thoughts for first-timers in the work world. 800-642-1234 is the number. Gorik, something I love about your book is you say, hey, if you try my advice and it works for you, or you've been successful in the work world, pay it forward. Help that new person who's looking bewildered on the job. Why is that important to you?
Well, for me at least, and for so many others, over 500 contributors to this effort, this project wouldn't have happened had these 500 individuals not paid it forward to me. I wouldn't have been able to help my mom get back on her feet without others paying it forward to us. And I feel like the workplace would be so much more enjoyable of a place if we had that mindset where managers, it can be easy sometimes to be, I would say, maybe short-tempered, for lack of a better word, with your new grads, because they've been sitting in the classroom for whether it's 12 to 16 years plus, waiting for assignments to come their way, waiting passively for their professors to tell them what to do. It can be frustrating sometimes to work with a new graduate, an intern, an apprentice. But so many of us, well, I would argue all of us, were once in that position. And so whatever frustrations that we each as individuals have encountered, if you're a manager, here's an opportunity for you to pay it forward to someone else who is following your footsteps. It just makes the world run better, and it makes the workplace that much more enjoyable place.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jay is with us in Madison. Jay, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call and wonderful material. My question is this, and I thought this was fascinating when I first read about it. Zappos, in the beginning of their existence, would, and I don't have the exact days down correctly, but I know that they would offer a new employee $3,000 bonus after about 6 or 8 weeks to quit. And that would be a tool to separate sort of your C and B players to your A players who are devoted. I wonder what you think of that tool and what your thoughts are.
I had not heard about that, Gorik, have you?
I have, and I've always found it intriguing. I think I have somewhat of a, on the one hand, on the other hand, answer to this, where on the one hand, it totally makes sense in the sense that if you're not sure that this is a relationship that will go anywhere, perhaps it's like a date. Maybe it's better to call it quits early on than to continue walking down this path and to give an out to both sides. On the other hand, one thing I've started appreciating more and more over the course of this research is how top performers are very much developed and not born. And so when I think of early career professionals in the workplace, again, if you've been spending the last 12 to 16 years plus of your life passively sitting in the classroom waiting for instructions to come to you, it may feel quite foreign to have to take ownership and to be proactive in the workplace. And so a manager who may be a little bit less patient may see that individual as a low performer, even though they just haven't learned some of these unspoken rules. And so I would encourage managers who may find themselves wanting to call it quits on a new hire to really do some self-reflection around, have I actually made these expectations known and explicit? Or am I expecting my new hires to be able to read my mind? Once you can check that box off, then I do think it's a good option. I'd be curious to get your thoughts as well.
Jay, what do you think?
Was presented, actually, it was a business case we did, and and we found it to be terrific trying to do just that, to separate the A players from the B players and the C players, and thinking that it would be effective, and the B and C players would probably end up costing the firm far more than $3,000 over time for all sorts of bullet points. So that to sort of, what is it, hire slowly and fire fast, or in this case, you're not firing, but you're giving them an opportunity to walk out themselves and move on. So the class, for the most part, and I was a student, went with thinking it was a pretty brilliant and radical idea.
Jay, thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate it. Gorik Ng is with us. His new book is called The Unspoken Rules, Secrets to Starting Your Career Off Right. Now, Gorik, you also talk about, you know, okay, you've got the job, you're doing well at the job, you've demonstrated your three C's, your competence, compatibility, and commitment. But you also talk about how to demonstrate potential, which sounds like a mysterious thing to me. How do you demonstrate what you could be, even though you're not that yet?
Right. Well, a framework that I introduce in the book is what's called the nine-box matrix. And listeners who have been a part of performance evaluation committees or work in human resources themselves might be familiar with this, where there are two axes. There's performance and there's potential. Performance is how good you are in your current job. Potential, on the other hand, is how well you can be expected to perform in your next job. So if you are, for example, a data analyst at a large corporation, well, performance might mean that you're doing your work fully, accurately, and promptly. You're number crunching and doing so accurately. However, if you want to get promoted, it's not always good enough to simply be able to crunch numbers. You need to show that you can communicate the insights that you're churning out. You need to be able to manage up and manage cross-functionally. You need to build relationships across the organization as well. This is where so many of these intangibles start coming in. And what so much of my book is about is showing that potential, showing that you can do more than just your baseline job. And when it comes to folks who may feel stuck, certainly there are a number of reasons why someone may not be getting promoted. But one of the common reasons I observe is someone expecting that they'll get promoted simply for doing their current job well, without necessarily taking that extra step, going the extra mile to show that, hey, I'm not just good at this current job. I can do all of these other things as well. I'm leadership material. You should be investing in my career just as I'm investing in the company.
In our last minute or so, Gorik, talk to those new grads out there. If they have the new job lined up, or if they're still searching for it right now, it can be tough. What kind of encouragement would you offer them?
I would say, give yourself credit for getting this far. When I talk to job seekers, especially during this pandemic, it could be easy and certainly demoralizing to think, well, I've only worked in retail, or I've only had this, or I haven't done this job before. One framework that I found helpful is to translate what you've done into the jobs that you're looking for. So a fill in the blank exercise that I like to do is to say, blank is just like blank. The only difference is blank. So if you were, for example, a paralegal and you want to work in marketing, just making this up, you may look at that experience and say, well, there's nothing that translates. But if you force yourself into such a framework, you could perhaps sell yourself as, hey, marketing is just like being a paralegal. The only difference is I'm selling a product or a service instead of selling my client at a law firm. Doing these little fill in the blanks can go a long way in not only giving yourself confidence, but also present you as more competent for the jobs that you're looking for. You have experience. You have what it takes. It's just a matter of conveying it and convincing yourself that you have it in you as well.
Gorik, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Gorik Ng, career advisor and research associate at Harvard University, with us to talk about his book, The Unspoken Rules, Secrets to Starting Your Career Off Right. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, kids sports are getting back into gear, but along with the call to play ball comes sideline harassment of referees. look at a plan to make ref harassment a misdemeanor here in Wisconsin. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. I just saw a link today at Smithsonian Magazine's website, which I look at from time to time. The article was 5 agritourism destinations to visit this summer. So, of course, I click. Will they pick some farm and food related tourism destination here in Wisconsin? I start scrolling. They've got Asheville, North Carolina. Nice farmers markets, apparently. The Finger Lakes in New York State with wineries, breweries and cideries along the lakes. Fresno County, California. Lots of orchards you can tour. The Willamette Valley in Oregon with wines, hazelnuts, farm tours, and hot springs. Hot springs sound nice. And then Wisconsin. Not one city or one county or one region, just the whole state. No surprise, the lead in the Wisconsin bid is all about cheese. Quote, the dairy state is home to more than 1,200 cheesemakers who make more than 600 different kinds of cheese, end quote. I haven't counted lately, but that sounds about right. They highlight the Ellsworth Dairy Cooperative, Mariecki Gouda, and Suncrest Gardens Pizza Farm. They throw in some cranberry bogs, maple sugaring, and cideries. They don't even get to the breweries or distilleries in the state. Or corn mazes. Those are coming too. Wisconsin, the whole state, an agritourism destination according to Smithsonian Magazine. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.